We have one more talk on extraterrestrial intelligence. Ken Turner is going to be speaking on, are we the only sentient beings in the universe? Okay.
Being the second speaker has advantage and disadvantage. The disadvantage is everything I'm going to say has been said, so go ahead and ask questions. The advantage is, though, my approach will be more scientific and less religious, less theology, although I'm going to come up with some conclusions, not unlike what Dale said, so I appreciate Dale's input. This slide you already showed, the vastness of the universe. What I want to look at, though, is if you go into a night sky where you can see the stars, which you can't in Southern California, you can't in Denver area, Vermont is where I come from, you see a very small magnitude 6 star between Cygnus, between Cassiopeia and the Squirrel, right there. It's a magnitude 6 star, and yet if you really had the Hubble telescope, that's what it is. It's our closest neighbor, Andromeda Galaxy, and as Dale mentioned, it takes 100,000 years from one end to the other, 100,000 light years for signals to travel. This is the closest, supposedly almost identically in shape. It's a galaxy, spiral galaxy, but we can't see ours because we are at the edge. It's here, it gives you a better idea. But the whole thing is the vastness of the universe, and here's a cartoon. As I understand it, they want an immediate answer, but the message was sent 3 million years ago. I mean, we really have got problems. Distances are such that that's one of the first problems about intelligent beings. This is the most recent one I could get from Kepler. The blue ones are the past ones. The yellow ones are the newest. And what you, this is the number of confirmed satellite, which is 4,696 of those. And the important thing is which of these is Earth-like. And that's why you have Earth, Neptune, and Jupiter. And Earth-like should be something that takes more than 200 days to go around the star. And it should be a rocky Earth like that. And there's supposedly 21 of these that have been identified. So that's some of the facts we have. Another fact is Cassini took a picture of our planet Earth, and that's right there, you can see. That's us. Carl Sagan called this the pale blue planet. Nothing in the universe. Who are we? Look at our own planet. It's just nothing. All right, so that's how the whole thing starts. And then you say, well, there must be some more to it than that. All right? To really do a systematic study, because there's a lot of speculation in this topic, I tried to make some systematic statements. Like the first basic assumption, physical laws on Earth, same throughout the universe. Two, life is carbon-based. That's all we know. And there's a reason for it, I'll show. Universe is 3.7 billion years old. Our Milky Way galaxy is, as you see, 100,000 light years, so it's horrific to cover that. Dark energy and matter make up 95% of the universe. Can you imagine you spend decades and decades studying the universe and only we understand 4.5%? Well, we have to be a little humble when we do these things. Universe is made up of 11 dimensions, 7 of which are hidden, which creates possibilities of different types of breakthroughs. The life essential properties of carbon forms single bonds, stable, double, and triple bonds with oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus. Double ring aromatic compounds make up the very base of our life, RNA and DNA. You know, the importance of carbon, that if anything exists physically, my guess is there has to be carbon-based. Strong carbon-carbon bonds can form indefinitely long chains, amino acids, proteins, and so on. And carbon is known from 10 million different compounds. Life is very complex, so you would guess, from what we know, it should be carbon-based. Except there's one exception, we'll come to that. All right, where should we look for it, is the next question. Our solar system, we obviously know it's not there. We heard this morning that we're just looking for even organic material on Mars, which is so close to us as a planet. The Milky Way galaxy, the universe, that's the whole science of astrobiology has come out. Basic physics, physical chemistry, and biochemistry has been involved. In fact, it was Fred Hoyle, Wickramasinghe, a couple decades ago, came up to the conclusion that microbial life is so, can send all kinds of tough environments, and then maybe cells, living cells all over the universe. There was a paper like that that he wrote. But how do we define life? That is the next question. I say it's carbon-based, but it also could be silicon-based. That's has four valence and can form chains, the silanes, the silicates, and silicone. And curiously enough, we have created life silicon-based. My computer is silicon-based. In fact, the robots that they form are all silicon-based, although the newest ones, if you read Science magazine, they're not attaching cells to combine the silicon base with carbon base to make it more effective as robots. But how do we, so we have microorganisms is the lowest level, bacteria and archaea, then plant life, then animal life, then intelligent life. The question, of course, the big question, which Dale covered enough that I won't go into details, how did life originate on Earth? That's the most, that's an unanswered question, and it's very fundamental, because that implies what could have happened elsewhere in the universe. Okay, the next thing is, what do the following tell us? One is SETI, as it was covered already. We've had four signals from space, gamma rays, neutron stars, pulsars, all have created a lot of excitement that there may be signals coming. The part I would mention a few points is the Franklin universe. Frank Drake was mentioned, but there's a much more detailed formula by Ward and Brownlee, which has, I will show you shortly. The Franklin universe provides the limitations of life, especially advanced life. Then there's a question of visitors in the past. How many of you have lost the red chariots of the gods? And then the answer to that came, crashed all the chariots. In other words, when you have so-called evidences of aliens, as a scientist, you first exhaust every natural explanation, okay? Then you go, if there's a residue that says, ah, we can't answer that. Well, poor whoever, Von Daniken, didn't think carefully and came up with it. It became very popular, but I love that book, Crash Course the Chariots. Anthropologists countered every single argument there. Now comes a very important one. Travel through wormholes. How many of you see Interstellar movie? Okay. I'm going to address this for a moment now. Let me skip this. Here it is. This is from Kip Thorne. He's one of my heroes. In fact, I attended his thesis presentation when I was in Princeton. He is the one who presented a lot about wormholes in which you can shortcut. It's a hyperspace, and you can shortcut long distances. Okay, and what he did is, this is in his book. I've taken it from his book. He said, let's Earth be two-dimensional. Okay, then we have two choices. Here is Vega. Here is the Earth. If you really take the distances of our four-dimensional space, it will take you 23 light years to get there. But if a wormhole existed, you can do it in 1 kilometer. And this was the essence of intergalactic. The problem, though, is he had a team of students who calculated the probability of a wormhole. And here is one result that Kruskal prepared. It forms, I mean, if you use the general theory of relativity, you can calculate wormholes. You can theoretically demonstrate that. But the problem is, they pinch, they last a very short period of time, and they disappear. Second problem is, even if you can keep it open, like in this case, it is such an unusual situation in which if light would travel, it would diverge instead of converging, and exotic matter should be created there, which has negative energy density. That's another problem that comes up. So if you put all these, and then it doesn't exist in nature. Well, we now know, there was a time when I was at Princeton, we even didn't know that black holes existed. Keep going, kept pushing that. And eventually, now no, we just said talk about Sekema, about them colliding, but there's no such thing as the existence of a wormhole. Can there be a super civilization who can create a wormhole and travel very quickly between galaxies? That remains open. So let's go back and look at the other one is about how about UFOs. You know, I presented this paper first at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science to the staff, created a lot of interesting discussion. Then I presented at Colorado School of Mines the same way. But then every time I'm through, well, how about UFOs? What are those? Well, I have another set of slides. I'm not going to bore you with that. As an aerodynamicist, my major was aerodynamics before I became a physicist. I spent 20 years studying the Blue Book and others, and had some pointers to that. But just maybe Q&A, we can do that. The Bible, much info of physical life. The much info of physical life on Earth. Hardly any mention of the universe. I'm glad Dale mentioned a couple of those verses in which the angels are bringing people from the elect from every side. That's only, is that a metaphor or in a real situation? We do not know. All right. So what I did is I went and visited some colleagues at the VLA site to see these gigantic systems, 27 of them. I took a picture of one of them. They're fantastic. These are the ones that listen to the universe. They don't do SETI at the VLA. It's Arecibo does it in other places. But I just wanted to get an idea how directed it is, how limited their scope it is, and if there's any signals, they will receive. That's me there standing. And what you know, watch is not that this is very big. This dude is very small. How did life start was covered. The one that was discredited has been the one with Urey and Miller. I'm not going to talk about that. In fact, I think Randy is going to cover misinformations about how life started. So it is obviously an unsolved problem. Okay, so here comes Enrico Fermi. Oh, incidentally, in the 11th century, the church considered any talk on life outside planet Earth as heretical. And the first person who got burned at the stake was poor Giordano Bruno in the 16th century, who claimed that there was life outside planet Earth. But he was a very unorthodox Catholic also. And so they burned him on the stake. At the stake. That settled that. But then comes Enrico Fermi. And, you know, he was a wonderful physicist. And he said, where are they? Okay, where are they? Let's look at some possibilities. One of them is they are here. They are here and meddling with human affairs. They're secret in some place, you know, you think. No. The second one is it is us. First Peter 2:11 says we are aliens. So when someone says, are there aliens on Earth? I say, hey, I'm one of them. Okay? Because of Apostle Peter. They were here and left evidence of their presence. That's the chariot. So. Or the zoo hypothesis. In other words, they are watching us, but they realize what a mess we are in. We are like zoo animals, killing each other all the time. They watch the whole, they use panspermia, they see the planet Earth, and they watch the evolutionary process, and they're just studying us. And they have no reason to communicate with us. Okay? These are some of the hypotheses. They exist, but they have not yet communicated, is another position. They are signaling, but we do not know how to listen. I was at lunch with Carl Sagan before he died. I invited him at the Sandy Laboratories when I was there. You know, he made a remark. He said, maybe they're trying to communicate with us with neutrinos, so we don't know how to listen to them. They have no desire to communicate, and so I don't believe them at all, given the condition on Earth we are. Not that we will subjugate them, or we could anyway, if we could. We have not listened long enough. You know, our technology is only over a 100-year period. Or the other question is, some people say they do not exist. And the one that they do not exist emphasizes a little more strongly is the so-called fine-tuned universe. In other words, there should be habitable zones, which immediately eliminates a number of planets. Life genesis is rare. And intelligence at the human level is even rarer. If you listen to Stephen Gould, he said if we were to work backwards and watch the whole, and have the evolutionary process start, the chance that there would be intelligent beings like us is zero. In other words, it is such an improbable event. That's his statement, very interesting. Habitable zone, here they are. The middle one is Earth. If the star is very small, of course, the habitable zone will be closer to the sun, but the problem there is the orbit can become synchronous and only one face would be against the sun, so that when there won't be possible, it would be more of the third type of habitable zone. This is one of my favorite, what you call it, it's a Greek mythology called the Ouroboro. I don't know where I got this. Has anyone seen this? With the inscription on it. What is interesting for me is if you look down, see, this is us, this is Adam and Eve, all right? And we have the macrocosm on this side, microcosm on this side. And what is extremely important for us, although we are in that blue speck planet, our minds are able to understand or investigate every part of nature, from macrocosm to microcosm, and here we are, right in the middle, as if someone has asked us, it's right there, to say, okay, go and investigate and understand the rest of the universe. To me, it is the first implication that there's something unique about us, the first step. Then, if you go into the book by Brownlee, Ward and Brownlee, Our Rare Earth, there are over 100 parameters that all have to be satisfied before you can have a planet like Earth where life can emerge. Our sun is a star with rich in metal. It has to be middle-aged, moving slowly, not in the center of the galaxy, not metal-poor galaxy, not near active gamma ray sources. Our solar system, planet with circular orbit, within habitable distance. If you were 5% or 15% either direction, water either would be vapor or frozen. And so animal life, bacterial life, yes, animal life cannot emerge. We have to have a near Jupiter to sweep away asteroids. These numbers actually started when I was at Princeton, and one of the physics students came up with the fine structure constant and did an analysis that showed that if a fine structure constant was 10% on either side, there would be no sun-like stars. It was the first constraint that came, and then it took off from there. Right now, I think it's about 100 of these. All right. So, large moon to keep our rotation at 24 hours. Gravity is such that both methane and ammonia, which are poisonous to animal life, do not exist in the atmosphere, but it is just right that if we're too much lower, we would lose our water as water vapor. So there's a very delicate balance there. As I think it was Fred Hoyle who said, someone has monkeyed with the universe. There are about 100 of these. So here is where that formula comes, and this is the only equation I'm going to show. Frank Drake was the first one to come up with that. We invited him to the Sandia Laboratories decades ago when I was there. You can tell that I'm how young I am. We took him to lunch, and at that point he had just come up with that equation. And so I really quizzed him about it, and he firmly believed that there's a lot more planets that can support intelligent life. But then Brown and Orby, which is a more recent paper, expanded that using these fine structure parameters, for example, N would be the number of planets that are Earth-like, N star would be suns, number of stars. F sub p is fraction that have planets. Fpm is fraction that have planets with metal. Ne is within the habitable distance from the sun. Ng is location in the galaxy that can make it habitable. So if you put all these parameters together and estimate, because you can estimate fractions, the number at the end, I haven't even completed these numbers, there are several other parameters, the Earth becomes rare, and that's their book, Rare Earth. There are not very many, not just like, not very many planets like ours where intelligent life or animal life can evolve or be created or survive, all right? And just a few years ago, Ward was interviewed, and they still believe, they take this formula, I haven't seen any improvement on this. It's basically the fact that fine-tuned universe causes problems. So the Earth becomes rare. What does rare mean? 10, 100, 100? But it's not very prevalent. The question is, are we unique as in the universe? All right, here I'm going to be rhetorical. I'm going to show you a little trick I use with my college students or high school students as to the importance of planet Earth. What I say is, God looked at 100 billion galaxies and kept pushing them away, came down to Milky Way galaxy and says, ah, that looks nice. Then he looked carefully at 100 billion stars and saw the sun, where the arrow is. This does not function anymore. Where the arrow is, and say, hey, that's an interesting sun. Let's see what it has. Victor did and found out that there were 9 planets. And he looked and said, one of them is beautiful. That's the blue Earth. And he fell in love with it. Although it's a speck in the in our planet system, it still was very attractive. So here's what he did. There was a soft landing 2,000 years ago that shook planet Earth. Why do we want to worry about our intelligence when God, the creator of the universe, loved, selected this tiny little speck and landed there to show who he is and to show how we can deal with our problems? And not only that, he died on the cross for us. Dale mentioned that John 3:16. If God considers planet Earth such a valuable planet in the entire universe, willing to come and land and spend time and try to relate to us, to me, rare becomes unique. I'm going to stop here. I don't want to get any more. One question comes up, though. God can create life anywhere, on any planet, right? He's a creator. My question is, if there is life elsewhere, Dave was mentioning, it's not fallen. We are the fallen people. Christ would not go around dying on planet Earth over and over and on the cross saying, my God, why you have forsaken me? To me, it's nonsense. That's why I think there's a uniqueness about us. I usually joke and get people all upset. I say, God made a big mistake. He created free will. He never will do that again on another planet. This is my story. Then, of course, there's the issue of UFOs, but if you have any questions on that, I can give you my view of it. I think we have a few minutes for questions. Thank you.
Neither you nor Dale spoke of multiverse theory, but there's certain intersection here. If there are other universes hypothesized by strain in multiverse theory, they could be fundamentally different in dimensionality and physical makeup. Is there an overlap? If so, what is it?
A good question. I know that always comes up. The problem is there's a multi-universe and all its physical laws are very different. There's no communication, so we can't even talk about that. to be have communication. We have to be part of the physical laws that we understand. That's one. And it's all this 10 to the 500, that's the calculation shows of humans. To me, that's a one setback argument. If you don't want to believe in God, you have to find out every solution to explain why our universe is unique. To me, it's such a speculation that, to me, the spiritual world is more believable. Heaven and hell is more believable than multi. But then there's no communication there at all. There can't be, by definition.
Mm-hmm. I would simply comment that my presentation will stay the same regarding the possibility of a multiverse. No change.
There's a question there.
I was interested in your comments about the possibility of life being based on silicon. And I'm wondering what kinds of compounds you have in mind in view of the fact that silicon analogs of hydrocarbons are very unstable, and silicon dioxide is such a thermodynamic sink. I think all of the usual kinds of compounds that we see in carbon-based life are not likely to be stable in the case of silicon.
In the case of what, silicon?
Silicon, yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's why life is not. To my conclusion is that life cannot be silicon-based. It would be robots, which we will send from one planet to another to reproduce themselves using the materials in that in the planet and continue populating the universe. But they would be robots, not living beings like we are based on carbon. This would be my way of differentiating the two, but it's not impossible.
When we talk about the rarity of life, when we talk about the rarity of life in the universe, or potential rarity, would we be better off talking about the mean spacing of possible intelligent life to give a better view of just how remote this life might be, rather than talking about the numbers in a vast universe?
I don't think I understand what you're saying. First, I'm limiting mine to the Milky Way galaxy. I'm not even looking about the universe. I'm talking about that's bad enough, you know, for lack of communication. What was the question again?
Would we be better off in terms of communication?
Yeah.
Talking about the mean spacing between possible sites of life and therefore intelligent life.
Yeah.
Just so that, because the numbers you say, well, there could be 200 in the Milky Way or some such number like that.
Yeah.
But somehow it doesn't mean a lot because we don't have a really good idea of the vastness.
Correct.
Of
correct. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I say communication, you know, in the 6,000 or 4,000 planets that are confirmed are over a 10-year, between 4 to 10-year light years, even that's long in the sense of communication, let alone someplace else in the vastness of the Milky Way galaxy. Communication is a serious setback, unless wormholes are formed and you can travel.
We have time for one more question.
I wanted to ask about the Ward-Brownlee equation and the rare earth hypothesis.
Yeah.
It seems to me that that focuses on trying to characterize what are the circumstances that led to life here on Earth, rather than asking a more general question, what are some other contexts in which life could emerge? It may have nothing to do with the Earth. So even on our own solar system, we're starting to find indirect evidence that there may be oceans, say, under the surface of Europa,
correct,
Costa Ganda, Callisto, Enceladus. So that kind of puts the lie to the usual notion of where the habitability zone may be. So could you comment on, if we ask the question about habitability in that more general sense, doesn't that significantly change the numbers?
Habitability can be more extensive if they're microorganisms. You know, they can, they're able to up to 50, 60 Celsius. You have bacteria, thermophila bacteria that can exist. This is why Fred Hoyle came to the conclusion that humans may be filled with cells, because they can, both are resistant to radiation, but animal life and human life, you're very restricted. And I believe in that, and that's why the word brownie makes sense to look at. Yeah, but microorganisms could, but now that, does that mean that eventually we lead to animal life? That's where the big problem comes. Yeah, I agree.
Thank our speakers once again.